A quick word from our sponsor, Oakstone CME's ACP MixApp Audio Companion. What would it feel like to have bite-sized MixApp teaching ready to go anywhere with you? Take a listen.
I found it very interesting, the line that points out that observational studies suggest an increase in heart failure with insulin therapy. That's something I hadn't known prior to this exercise.
Yes, and a lot of patients now are interested in considering a GLP-1 receptor agonist. These drugs reduce major adverse cardiovascular events but have no effect or detriment in patients with heart failure.
And on top of the high-yield teaching, they give you supplementary content, monthly multiple-choice questions discussion, so that really brings the clinical pearls to life. It's a really smart way to reinforce key concepts without high-effort setup. For 50 years, Oakstone CME has helped busy clinicians stay current with expert-led education free of outside commercial influence. From board prep to earning CME, their mobile-friendly platforms offer trusted multimedia content designed for learning on the go. Multitask while you absorb the latest medical knowledge with ACP MixApp Audio Companion, a podcast-style tool packed with expert insights, board prep, and more CME credits than ever. You can stream or download anytime. And exclusive for Coram listeners, use the code CORE25 for 25% off. Go to oakstone.com/mixapp. That's oakstone.com/MKSAP. Use the code CORE25. And with that, let's get into the episode.
I've said this multiple times, and I can't believe I've said this multiple times, being a proceduralist, but you know, you just can't shake the internist at heart. Now, this is where your pretest probability for these things is so critical.
That's Chris Kapp, an interventional pulmonologist at Northwestern. Welcome to the CoreAM 5 Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi.
And I'm Dr. Kalila Pice, an internal medicine resident at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Today, we're talking about the interpretation of pleural fluid studies.
And we'll also touch on some common pleural diseases like paradigmatic effusions, as well as malignant pleural effusions. All right, so let's dive in with the pearls we're going to cover today. Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl one, to thoracentesis or to not?
When should we think about thoracentesis?
Pearl two, a deep dive into the LITES criteria and pseudoexudates.
What are some things to think about when using LITES criteria, and what are some other diagnostic tests we can use to augment?
Pearl 3, analyzing pleural fluid studies.
What are some common pitfalls with the pleural pH as well as the cell differential?
Pearl 4, the spectrum of paradigmatic effusions.
How do we identify and treat paradigmatic effusions?
Pearl 5, malignant pleural effusions.
How do we diagnose and manage malignant pleural effusions? Okay, Kalila, let's do a quick refresher on pleural effusions before we get into all the nuances with pleural studies. So first, on to imaging pearls, and then when to pull the trigger on thoracentesis.
So first things first, pleural effusions are when there is a buildup of fluid in the pleural space. That is, the space between the parietal and visceral pleura.
And fun fact, it's actually normal to have a little bit of fluid in the pleural space, like pretty minimal, 30 to 50 cc's.
And the reason why it's there is because that little bit of fluid helps as a lubricant, which allows the lungs to move freely. And on an AP portable chest x-ray, we can see a meniscus forming or some blunting of the costophrenic angle at around 200 cc's of the fluid. You can see that pleural effusion at even lower volumes, around 50 cc's.
So x-rays are great and appreciate those nuances, but I always feel like focus is better. It's more sensitive for the fluid. It's easy to do repeatedly at the bedside. You can follow that effusion over time. And Dr. Christina Montemir, a pulmonary critical care doctor at Johns Hopkins and one of the co-founders of the podcast Palm Peeps, reminded us how POCUS can be used to actually see features of the effusion itself.
As a resident, I have called for a thoracentesis because it looked like there was complete whiteout of right lung. And then I went with the IP fellow and we actually ultrasounded it. And it's like, oh, like this is not fluid. This is actually, you know, cancer and it's solid component and there's no fluid around it. But I wouldn't have known that if I went and did an ultrasound or at the bedside.
Ah, great story.
And maybe the most important thing with imaging with our patients is that we can actually show our patients their images, and those images can be really powerful.
A lot of people, when you're talking about, like, you have an effusion, they're like, what is that? Is it in the lung itself? Is it outside of the lung? So I actually like to show them, like, their actual image, whether it's chest x-ray or if they got the CT, or even just showing them on our bedside ultrasound, like, this fluid here, like, shouldn't be here. And you may be having your symptoms because of this. So, like, here is a procedure that we can do. So I try to, like, at least let them visualize, you know, what is abnormal and the amount of fluid that we potentially could take off and how that could help them from a therapeutic standpoint as also from a diagnostic standpoint. Patients sometimes are like, wow, like, that much fluid was in me. Like, I can't believe that. Or they're just surprised to see, like, they're like, what color is it?
Yes, I think this is the biggest thing I've changed in my practice is showing patients their actual radiology findings day and night in terms of their understanding, the kinds of questions I get back, the misconceptions I can clarify.
So once we know that we have a pleural effusion, something that we need to think about is if we should drain it or sample it with a thoracentesis. That way, we can ensure that we're ruling out any of those can't miss diagnoses like infection or malignancy.
So I think by and large, in a new unilateral pleural effusion, everybody that can safely get a thoracentesis should probably get a thoracentesis.
We also sat down with Dr. Dave Ferfaro, one of the pulmonary and critical care doctors at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, and the other co-founder of Palm Peeps. These are his thoughts on thoracentesis.
And then in that same vein, if I am having bilateral effusions and I am trying to treat it and I'm really not making any progress and it starts to make me question my underlying diagnosis, that I might try to get a little bit more information. Or if there are some red flag features, like the patient seems to really clinically have a bad pneumonia. And so even though there are two effusions there, one of them could be a paramnemonic, they might not be the same process. Someone has a known underlying malignancy and they could certainly have metastases to multiple parts of their body, then I'm going to go ahead and tap the larger one, the bigger one, to try to get some diagnostic information.
So the takeaway for when to do a thoracentesis, we can ask ourselves, one, is it a unilateral effusion? Two, is it a bilateral effusion that's not getting better with your interventions? Or three, are there any red flag signs like significant dyspnea, fever, weight loss, hemoptysis, where you would really want to work up that pleural effusion more?
And something that really stuck with me after speaking with our discussant is that it is super important to not anchor.
I always have to tell myself is to not anchor. Up to 30% of pleural effusions do have more than one etiology. So if you get your fluid studies back and it's transudative, that doesn't necessarily mean there's not something else going on.
I love that. The good old two things can be true lesson rears its head again. And just to, like, say it explicitly with some examples, right? A patient can have a malignant pleural effusion and also heart failure contributing. Or for example, a patient could have a paraneumonic effusion, but also have severe hypoalbuminemia, say their albumin is less than 1.5 milligrams per deciliter, and that could also be contributing to the fluid buildup.
Okay, so let's recap. Pleural effusions are pathologic states in which there's a buildup of excess fluid in the pleural space. When to tap an effusion is dependent on the individual patient, but you should consider if this pleural effusion is new and it hasn't been evaluated before, if it's bilateral or unilateral, and if there are any red flag signs like fevers, pleuritic pain, pneumonias, or a lack of improvement after you've given what you think is appropriate therapy.
And finally, don't anchor. Studies show that up to 30% of pleural effusions can have more than one etiology. And actually, I bet that number is just rising with our patients getting more and more complicated.
Okay, so say you get that thora on a patient. Now it's time to interpret the studies, keeping in mind that all of this is done in the context of the patient in front of us.
Yeah, and typically I'd use the Lights criteria, but recently I have actually been seeing people use a pleural fluid only rule, which actually includes pleural cholesterol. So I think it'd be helpful to go over the pros and the limitations of each.
Yeah, let's start with the Lights criteria. I just want to say that every time I hear this story, I am truly blown away. It turns out that Richard Light was a resident when he submitted his prelim findings, and he submitted it to the American Thoracic Society in 1971, and they actually rejected him. And then he believed in his work, so he submitted it again, his manuscript, to the Annals of Internal Medicine, and this time it was accepted, and now it's a landmark study.
Man, imagine that. If that is not a motivator to believe in your work and your passion, I don't know what is.
So just to say it, the LITES criteria is if you meet any of the following, it's an exudative fluid. So one, if the pleural fluid to serum protein ratio is greater than 0.5, if the pleural fluid to serum LDH ratio is greater than 0.6, or if the pleural fluid LDH is greater than 2/3 the upper limit of normal for the lab. I don't know. I feel like I've tried so hard trying to remember this and try to like squint at the 0.5 and the 0.6 and try to make some connections. But Chloe, do you have a better way you remember these numbers?
Yeah, I think it's hard for me too, but what I do is that if the pleural protein and the LDH is more than half of the serum protein and LDH, then I kind of assume that it's exudative. But I do think a better way is probably understanding the pathophysiology.
And in transudates, when that fluid is relatively simple, we're really thinking about the hydrostatic and oncotic pressure. And is there some reason that more fluid is just going across? And so those are things like heart failure, fluid overload from renal failure, low albumin states where you have low oncotic pressure, and just sort of simple fluid builds up in that space. And then we think the exudative side of more complex fluid, this is really when something's happened to that barrier and it's not functioning normally. So some sort of injury or inflammatory process, some pathologic state that's leading more cells, more protein, more sort of complex material to go into that pleural space. And in either case, the buildup of fluid in that space can impact the lungs that are right there adjacent to the pleura. And that's why we care about them so much.
Oh, that's awesome. That like really helps imagine why then the protein pleural to serum ratio greater than 0.5 and why the LDH pleural to serum ratio greater than 0.6 makes sense for exudative and not for transudative because you have all these proteins and LDH leaking into the pleural space.
LITES criteria is wonderful. It works really well. I think the thing that it's best at is identifying that it's a transudate. So if you don't meet any of those criteria, I feel really, really comfortable that this is a simple transudative effusion.
So when LITES criteria called something transudative, we can feel very confident in that. But it does beg the question, are we sure in the same way about the exudative effusions?
It does have some flaws of maybe, I hate to say overcalling exudates, but that is the criticism of it, is that sometimes it can overcall exudates. The reason that it might have some propensity to do this is that you're actually using LDH twice, right? And so you are using this ratio and you're using the higher limit of normal, and that can skew things quite a bit.
Yeah, that's a good thing to consider. And then another critique of the LITES criteria is about pseudo-exudates. These are effusions that are classified as exudative effusions based on the LITES criteria, but actually their underlying etiology is transudative.
And this is pretty common. I was surprised to learn that 20 to 30% of so-called exudative effusions are actually associated with things like heart failure or liver failure, which is classically actually transudative.
The other thing is that we know that people who have a lot of effusions are often overloaded. And if you're on chronic diuretic therapy, you can, for lack of a better word, concentrate your pleural space, right? So fluid is going in, it has certain components, you're slamming them with diuretics to get them to urinate more, and some of that fluid will get drained by the lymphatics and back into circulation, and you sort of concentrate the fluid that's left in the pleural space. And so in those cases, we sometimes call that like a pseudo-exudative effusion.
So I'd say the takeaway is that diuretics can concentrate pleural fluid and increase pleural protein and LDH levels. This is humbling because if our patient who has heart failure or a hepatic hydrothorax is being diuresed and we get a thora, we might go down this rabbit hole of trying to work up an exudative effusion that is actually just a pseudo-exudate.
And so the good thing and the good news is that there's actually three other things we can look at to help be a tiebreaker and actually help us kind of see, ha, that's a pseudo-exudate and not an actual exudate. So the first of the three is you're going to peek over at the difference between the albumin in the serum and that of the pleural fluid.
Yeah, so similar to the SAG calculation in cirrhosis, this is more formally known as the serum pleural albumin gradient, or SPAC.
And the second thing we look at is the difference between the protein in the serum and the pleural, aka the serum pleural protein gradient, or the SPIG.
But this does make sense because if you look at the pathophysiology, in a transudative effusion, it's the hydrostatic and oncotic pressures that are driving the fluid into the pleural space. So you would expect that those larger molecules like albumin and protein are too big, and so they would stay in the serum and not move into the pleura. So there would be a larger difference in the serum pleural protein or albumin gradient.
Yes. And then put to put numbers on it and help make sense why these numbers make sense, right? If the difference between the protein levels in the serum and the pleural fluid is greater than 3.1 grams per deciliter, that's going to point to transudative. And again, if the difference between the serum pleural albumin gradient is greater than 1.2 grams per deciliter, then that's going to also point to transudative. Again, those big molecules are staying in the serum and not going to the pleural. So you're going to see a bigger difference.
And then the third and last thing that can help us objectively differentiate a pseudoexudate is the pleural proBNP. If it's greater than 1500, then it is most likely due to heart failure. And the idea is that if there is so much BNP in the blood, it'll likely leak into the pleural space.
Nice. All right. I think we covered a lot of good ground with LITES criteria and kind of some of the nuances to unpack there. Let's move on to the pleural fluid only rule. An effusion is an exudate if the pleural protein is greater than 3 grams per deciliter, if the pleural cholesterol is greater than 45 milligrams per deciliter, or the LDH is greater than 0.45 times the upper limit of normal.
And this is great because it only uses pleural studies, so you don't need that serum level comparison. It also doesn't duplicate the LDH like the LITES criteria does. But let's think about why we're using the pleural cholesterol. Why would it be higher in exudative effusions?
There have been some pretty good data to suggest that a cholesterol level above 40 is consistent with exudate, and below 25 is very consistent with transudate. I do send it a lot of the time. You know, I think it can be useful in those situations where you're borderline, you know, maybe one of LITES criteria is positive. So I think having that test and, it, you know, if it's really high, then it can really point to you that, yeah, there's some inflammation going on just because the pathophysiology of utilizing the cholesterol is thought to be related to degenerating cells and vascular leakage from increased permeability. And that is more consistent with kind of an exudative effusion.
So there are two schools of thought. One is that inflammatory pleural cells are releasing cholesterol when they degenerate. And the second thought is that because that pleural cholesterol is derived from the plasma and the pleural capillaries are more permeable in these exudative states, that plasma cholesterol is actually able to enter into the pleural cavity.
That's awesome, right? So I feel like if we get a pleural cholesterol over 45, then we can be pretty confident it's exudative. Should we just be using the pleural fluid only criteria and then just retire the LITES criteria?
You know, and I think the reason that LITES criteria has stood the test of time for so long is it just works. And so, you know, there's no reason to kind of debunk something that isn't necessarily broken. You know, if it's not broke, why would we try to fix it? You know, I think these other evaluations are great because we always want to improve upon ourselves. So I think the cholesterol was additive. And I think the albumin gradient can be additive in the right patient. But I think that the reason that the LITES criteria stood the test of time is just because of that reason. You know, it just works.
I mean, ultimately, the pulmonologists say that we should still use the LITES criteria. And this is because the LITES criteria gives us a higher sensitivity, so it's able to catch a lot of those really scary exudative effusions that we don't want to miss.
So why don't we summarize this pearl so far? When we're classifying an effusion as transudative or exudative, we got to think about the physiology here. With transudative effusions, it's really increased hydrostatic and low oncotic pressure that's at play. And then with exudative effusions, there's injury and inflammation causing leaky capillaries. And then we have these big molecules like protein, albumin, LDH, cholesterol leaking into the pleural space. And that really helped for me understand why the LITES criteria ratios are a certain way to capture that.
And LITES criteria is helpful, and we do have to keep in mind that it uses LDH twice, so it can overcall exudates.
And a pseudoexudate is basically when you use LITES criteria and it calls it an exudate, but actually, in reality, it's a transudative effusion. And there's three tools that can help us better clarify the effusion. It's going to be the difference between the serum and the pleural albumin, the difference between the serum and pleural protein. If it's high, if those differences are high, then it's a transudate. And also, if you're concerned about a cardiac etiology, get a NT-proBNP. If it's higher than 1500, then that also points to a transudative state.
And lastly, pleural fluid cholesterol levels will be elevated in exudative effusions due to cell degeneration and capillary permeability.
I am so excited to have EchoCore 500 digital stethoscope as a sponsor. I actually learned about them accidentally a year or so ago when I'd forgotten my stethoscope and my resident let me borrow his, and I just was like, wow, I've never heard heart sounds or lung sounds this clearly. You just get this extra level of confidence for those moments where you're asking, was that faint crackles? Was that an S3 gallop? And so that's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies sounds 40x. And then on top of that, it has noise cancellation so you can really hear with precision in a noisy ED or with a really loud roommate or other environments. Echo AI is also built in and helps you detect murmurs and AFib earlier. A cool thing also is that you can record that heart sound that you heard, share it later with your team, or on a case presentation. And then you can really trust the diagnostic accuracy. It's backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for the devices and the AI algorithms. So those who use Echo are twice as likely to catch heart disease. What I think is neat is that Echo 500 isn't just the digital stethoscope. You can actually also get an EKG tracing right on the app when you place an Echo 500 on a patient's chest. So no more waiting around trying to trace down the EKG machine on the floor. I trust Echo so much that I work with a team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/corium. Your purchase will be HSA and FSA eligible and may also qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you're going to detect heart and lung sounds more confidently. And if you don't, you can return it with a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/corium for $50 off plus a free chest cover. That's ekohealth.com/corium. And with that, let's get back into the episode. Let's be real. It can be hard to eat healthy without feeling like you're giving up flavor or fun. And one of my favorite freezer finds that checks all the boxes is frozen Washington red raspberries. They're grown with care by American family farmers in Washington State. They're picked at peak ripeness and frozen within hours, so you get that natural, delicious flavor, and they're always in season. There's no added sugar. They're packed with nutrients. It's only 80 calories a cup, 8 grams of fiber, a great source of vitamin C, folate, low glycemic index. I love tossing them into my morning smoothies or putting them in yogurt. It tastes so fresh. And also, I just feel good that in the morning, there's something that I'm starting my day with that's real and better knowing that I'm supporting local U.S. farmers with every bag. And so you can find Washington red raspberries at Costco, Kroger's, Wineco Foods. Just look for product of the U.S. on the label on the bag. They're even in things that you might already love, like Kirkland's 3 Berry Blend, Smucker's Raspberry Jam, and those Uncrustables with raspberry filling. So visit redras.org. You can find recipes, health tips, retail locations near you. That's redras, redraz.org. And with that, let's get back to the episode. So we talked about pleural fluid, LDH, protein, cholesterol, pro-NT-BNP, all helpful things, but there are also a bunch of other tests we often get with our pleural studies, particularly the pleural pH and the cell differential.
Yeah, I'm really excited for us to talk a little bit more about all of these. So let's start with the pleural pH.
And just remind everyone, a normal pleural pH is about 7.6. In most exudative perfusions, we'll get a pH less than 7.3.
And if the pH is less than 7.2, this could mean a very poor prognosis for our patients. And it increases the likelihood of that pleural space needing to be drained with a chest tube.
Yeah. And speaking of like super low pHs, I've definitely been tricked by a super low pleural fluid pH in a patient that was actually well appearing, like eating a sandwich. And turns out it was actually the local lidocaine that was used prior to the Thora that's acidic in nature. And then when it came in contact with the pleural fluid, falsely lowered that pleural pH. And then on repeat diagnostic Thora, which is unfortunate that we had to get it, the repeat Thora did show that the pH was actually normal all along. And the same thing can happen with if there's some residual heparin in a syringe.
Wow, that's crazy and kind of scary. And I think these stories bring up a really important point that we're looking at everything, including the patient, in addition to those pleural studies.
Beware when your patient's eating a grilled cheese sandwich and their pleural pH is 7.1.
That's true. Okay, the other thing that we should know is that the pH does change depending on the time outside of the body. And so if there's a delay more than even an hour, it can falsely elevate the pH. And that can be falsely reassuring.
Now, why don't we move on to the cell count and the differential? In a normal pleural fluid, we would expect there to be very few white blood cells and only will be neutrophils.
Okay, so if there's a neutrophil predominance, we can imagine that that's probably an acute process that's going on, especially at levels greater than 50% of neutrophils. But we should keep in mind that different populations matter. So in our lung transplant patients, even at 21% of neutrophils, we are worried about an infection.
Yeah, and the other takeaway here is that neutrophils just mean acute inflammation, right? It doesn't necessarily mean infection.
Yeah, exactly. So like more than half of our patients with pulmonary embolisms will have a neutrophil predominant pleural effusion, which makes sense because PEs are a very acute process.
Right. Nice. All right. Let's move on to lymphocytes. So usually we can expect there to be about 20% lymphocytes in the pleural fluid. But say we have more than 50% of lymphocytes, then we're going to think about more chronic processes going on.
And then lymphocyte predominant is sort of the big, large bucket. Lymphocyte predominant can be seen in malignancy, but it's also the most likely type of effusion for someone who has an idiopathic effusion. So somebody has recurrent effusions, we can't figure out why. It's usually a lymphocyte predominant process. Lymphocyte predominant can be seen in malignancy, certainly. It can be seen in some sort of more indolent infections. You know, tuberculosis sort of being the classic one.
And then if the pleural fluid lymphocyte is greater than 80, 90%, really like numbers that make your eyes pop when you look at the EMR, that's going to be suggestive of like more rare things, right? Like lymphoma, chylothorax, tuberculosis.
And say you are worried about TB in someone with a lymphocytic predominant effusion, your next step would be adding on something like an ADA or adenosine deaminase.
ADA is an interesting test in the sense that, you know, I think in the right patient population, it can be super, super helpful. So if you have a patient from an endemic area of TB and they have a pleural effusion, sending an ADA can be super helpful. If it's elevated, it can help you cinch the diagnosis because culture data from an AFB from the pleural fluid is really low. You're going to get an answer about 10 to 15% of the time. So an ADA can be very supportive.
And so in normal conditions, an ADA in the pleural fluid is low. So if you send off an ADA and it comes back less than 40 international units per liter, we can generally exclude tuberculosis pleuritis.
Let's move on to eosinophils. There should be almost 0% of eosinophils in the pleural space. So if you have more than 10%, there are quite a few things it could possibly be.
Eosinophils really can be from grab bag of things, but anything that irritates or violates the pleura will lead eosinophils to be there. So somebody has a rib fracture, somebody has a pneumothorax, somebody has actually had a prior TAP. There are certain types of malignancies or inflammatory conditions can do that.
Then one of our reviewers even noted that some of the most often misdiagnoses he sees with his residents and fellows when it comes to eosinophils in the pleura, in his opinions, are more of the rare things like asbestos-related pleural effusions or tuberculosis pleuritis.
Yeah, and those are definitely things you don't want to miss. I was also really surprised to hear that no diagnosis is even obtained in about a third of patients with eosinophilic pleural effusions.
Ah, man, idiopathic stuff is always so humbling and how often it comes up. So the last part of our cell count and diff is the number of RBCs.
A lot of your pleural effusions are going to have a fair amount of red blood cells on them, but you really need a very high percentage or a very high number of red blood cells for that to be consistent with the hemothorax. The best test for that is actually to send a pleural fluid hematocrit. And if it's greater than 50% of the serum hematocrit, then you're looking at a likely hemothorax.
So to reiterate, if we look at the ratio of pleural fluid to blood hematocrit and it's greater than 0.5, this is diagnostic of a hemothorax.
And then another cool trick we learned is that when you're sending off pleural fluid for culture, you can actually place that sample straight into the blood culture bottle, and that's going to increase our yield.
There's a recent paper, it's a couple years old now, but inoculating your blood culture bottles at the bedside before you send them to the lab improves your yield by about 10 to 12%. So it's actually my practice now where I draw the fluid and then either myself or someone else who's in the room just directly inoculates 10 cc's into the blood culture bottles just to improve your yield.
Okay, so we learned about a lot of tests. So let's summarize some of our takeaways. A normal pleural pH is around 7.6, but numbers below that, like 7.3, suggest an exudative effusion. And then do try to get the samples into the lab as soon as possible, or else you might have a falsely elevated pH.
And when we look at the cell count of the pleural fluid, if there's greater than 50% of neutrophils, we can think that that's an acute process. And if there are high lymphocytes, this could be a chronic process like malignancy or even TB. If we are worried about TB, we should send off an ADA to help.
Right. And then eosinophilic effusions, that can be just like anything that irritates the pleura. And if the pleural to serum hematocrit ratio is greater than 0.5, this indicates a hemothorax. All right, now let's take some of our interpretation of pleural studies and apply it to diagnosing and treating paraneumatic effusions.
Yeah, I think a great example is trying to distinguish between uncomplicated and complicated paraneumatic effusions.
And in an uncomplicated process, you just have pneumonia there in the lung. The pleural space gets irritated. yes, more protein and cells and things are pouring into there, but you don't sort of have a frankly infected space. It's just sort of next to this infected lung. And in those cases, we feel a lot more comfortable trying to just treat the pneumonia and have the fluid maybe be drained once as we're doing the diagnosis, but we're just sort of monitoring it.
And with these cases, when we look at the pleural fluid biomarkers in uncomplicated effusions, this is basically when fluid itself is not infected. We can expect a negative Gram stain, a negative culture. The glucose level of the pleural fluid is going to be greater than 60, and the pH is going to be greater than 7.2.
And this is different from a complicated parapneumonic effusion. This is when bacteria is actually inside the pleura. And for this reason, we call it complicated because it needs to be drained to be resolved.
Man, I don't know if I'm like dating myself here, but there was a time on Facebook where people would actually update their relationship status as complicated. And I can't help but think about the parallel that those complicated relationships just needed some drainage to help it out.
I love that. I think we can keep running with it. So our complicated relationships are less sweet, kind of like the complicated effusions where our glucose is less than 60 because of all of the bacteria. And I would also say that our complicated relationships can sour, kind of similar to the complicated effusions, which are going to be more acidic with our pH less than 7.2.
Nice. Oh, that was so good. I love that. All right, another pro tip on pleural glucose being low is that, yes, we have this cutoff of the glucose being less than 60, but it's not a hard and fast, especially if you take the patient's serum glucose into account.
Now, this is the situation where I think having a serum level is helpful because you want to see if the glucose level is significantly lower than the serum level. If you have a patient who has a glucose level in their serum of 400 and you have a glucose level in your pleural fluid of 70, then I think infection is going to be going higher on my list of potential diagnoses.
And annoyingly, the Gram stain and culture might be negative or positive depending on the stage of disease or where you tap. But if you do see the LDH being greater than 1,000, or if you see loculations or septation, that loculation or septation on bedside ultrasound or a CT can really help you clench the diagnosis.
If I see septations, if I see loculations in a really complex space, that's going to be a complicated effusion. I don't actually even care what the fluid characteristics look like because I can't be positive that the fluid characteristics from one pocket are the same as another pocket. And so if it looks really complicated on my bedside ultrasound or on a CAT scan, I'm going to call that a complicated effusion.
And just to say explicitly, I really appreciate hearing how a sample fluid in one pocket of a loculation or septation may be different than another. And that's why we might see a higher number of bacteria in one pocket versus another.
Yeah. And last but not least, if you tap an effusion and you get frank pus, that is not just a complicated effusion anymore. That is empyema.
So let's get a little bit more granular in terms of treatment of these complicated parapneumonic effusions and empyema. There's two main buckets, drainage of the pleural space with a chest tube and antibiotics.
I would make sure that those antibiotics have anaerobic coverage in them because you're almost thinking of this as like an abscess. But I at first have much lower threshold to add antibiotics that cover the broad spectrum bugs that we most worry about, like Pseudomonas and MRSA.
And with the chest tubes for parapneumonic effusions and empyema, sometimes we need just a little bit more help with the drainage. And that's where fibrinolytic therapy comes in. And there was an age-old debate about which therapy we should use. Is it TPA? Is it Dornase? Is it both? The MIS-2 trial gives us our answer.
TPA Dornase actually did improve both radiographic outcomes and decrease the need for surgery. There were no effect on mortality or hospital length of stay. The caveats to using TPA Dornase, I think, are one, if you have a really thickened pleural rind, it's not going to be effective at decorticating or getting rid of that pleural rind. So the patient's going to have some lung entrapment. These medicines are not going to fix that. Two, there was a very good retrospective review of a very large data set that looked at the safety of TPA Dornase. Essentially, the bleeding rate is pretty low. It's somewhere between 2 and 4%. But if your odds ratio for bleeding from TPA Dornase out of the pleural space goes up if you cannot stop anticoagulation. So in those situations, you know, you should really consider dose reducing or maybe not using it because, you know, obviously you don't want to cause a pleural bleed in those patients.
Yeah. So to help recap the MIS-2 trial and management, if we can, the combination of TPA and Dornase is preferred in our patients
with complicated fusions and empyema because it reduces the need for surgery, which is always a good thing. But we do have to keep in mind if our patients on CT have a thickened pleural rind or lung entrapment, aka the lung can't fully expand because of some active disease, the tPA Dornase might not be as effective.
And I think a good way to end this pearl is with a PSA that paraneumonic effusions are scary. And the reason we care so much about them is because if we don't act in time, of course, the patient could become very sick and septic. Ultimately, they may require a VATS decortication, which is a very painful and invasive procedure that sometimes we can otherwise avoid.
You know, I think the old adage of the sun never sets on a pleural effusion is probably only really applicable anymore to patients who you're suspecting an empyema. This is the consult that, you know, you see a pneumonia and a pleural effusion. This is the consult that probably should happen even if it's 4 o'clock, you know, on a Thursday, you know, or on Friday or even on the weekend. You know, this is something that probably shouldn't sit and wait, you know, especially with kind of some of the more advanced treatments we have, but it should be acted upon quickly, certainly within 24 hours.
So to summarize, we have paraneumatic effusions and they really exist on a spectrum. On one end, it's uncomplicated, meaning it's not infected fluid and just kind of sitting near pneumonia, to complicated effusions, which is actual bacteria in the pleural space, to on the other end of the spectrum, empyema, which is frank pus. We can help distinguish these because complicated effusions and empyema will have a glucose less than 60, a pH less than 7.2, and an LDH greater than 1000. And I, again, really appreciate hearing that if you see septations or loculations on ultrasound or CT, that can be enough to call it complicated.
And so treatment of these complicated effusions and empyemas require a chest tube. And sometimes they also require a little bit more help with breaking up the loculations using tPA and Dornase therapy. And for antibiotics in complicated effusions and empyemas, we want to include anaerobic coverage. And then we should also consider broader coverage like for Pseudomonas and MRSA.
Okay, so say we are worried about malignancy in a patient. Say someone's coming in with a unilateral pleural effusion, some weight loss, some vague symptoms, and we need some pleural studies.
There's been some data that has been published about how much fluid to send. You want to send at least 50 cc's in this day and age of needing next generation sequencing and molecular testing and things like that. It's probably a good idea to send more than that. Your yield from your initial pleural fluid cytology is generally speaking around 50 to 60 to 65%. If you're in that 30 to 40% where you don't get an answer, your second one, you will get an answer 25 to 30% of the time. So that second thoracentesis is usually the recommended thing. One, it can be diagnostic in over a quarter of cases. And two, you drain the patient dry and they feel better, right? And then if you still don't have a diagnosis after that second one, then pursuing kind of a more definitive biopsy is recommended as long as it's within the patient's kind of plan and goals and things like that.
And what's the definitive pleural biopsy? We can ask our proceduralist whether it's medical thoracoscopy with IP or VATS with our thoracic surgery colleagues.
But either way, once we've confirmed malignant pleural effusion, I think the next big question is, well, what do we do? And I think I ask that because a lot of these effusions are going to come back.
So I think the way that I counsel patients is I tend to be fairly conservative. You know, I think we do a thoracentesis, we get a diagnosis of a malignant effusion. I tell patients almost universally that we should wait, see what happens, and then determine based on the rapidity with which the fluid comes back. If the fluid comes back quickly within a week, then at that point, I'm talking to them about the various management options.
Yeah, one of those management options is to repeat the thoracentesis. So we want to give the patients a heads up because they may be coming back every week or every 2 weeks. And that can be a lot for our patients.
Definitely. And so another option is an indwelling pleural catheter, right? They don't have to come in for that. And it's this basically soft silicone tube that's inserted into their pleural space. It's not very visible. It can be drained at home. And so some people prefer that one.
Sonal pleural catheter placement is ideal in the sense that it keeps you out of the hospital. I mean, it's as simple as putting in a chest tube, essentially, but about a 4 to 10% infection risk for the lifetime of the catheter. And most of the time, it's just colonization and you can treat through it and keep the catheter in. But sometimes it does lead to full-blown pleural sepsis or it clogs the catheter up. So you have to remove it, potentially put a new catheter in and expose you to antibiotics. And then the other big thing I always tell patients is like you can't keep in a body of water or take a bath and you can't lay on that side, generally speaking. So you really have to, you know, I try to provide as much informed consent as possible.
Oh, I actually did not know about the bath thing. And I appreciate that because I feel like nurses pages all the time if like, oh, can this person shower or not? And
I guess now I know I can say, yes, they can shower, especially knowing that, like, you know, it's not like hospitals have baths of like with a big body of water or like those cold water morning plunges that people are really into now. So that's good to know.
An alternative option to the repeated thoracentesis and the indwelling catheter is pleuridesis. And this is when we put a sclerosing substance into the patient's pleural space. What it does is cause irritation of the pleura, and this ultimately results in the two pleura sticking together. And this prevents fluid buildup with the effusion.
So going back to Richard Light, he used to call giving a sclerosing agent, and these are some of the older sclerosing agents that were probably more painful, but he used to refer to it as tacky lordy syndrome, where the patient would get tachycardic and say, lordy, 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 which is very corny, but it, you know, I think it does serve a purpose that it can cause some pretty significant inflammation in the pleural space. And so having an understanding of maybe how we're going to manage pain prior to doing this and then counseling your patient, like, yeah, this can cause a fairly significant pleuritic type pain. So I am usually injecting bupivacaine before I do any sort of pleurodesis because it's a little longer lasting than lidocaine with a half-life. And then making sure, as long as they can tolerate taking it, NSAIDs are generally speaking the best for this. If not, then you're still going to want to hit it from multimodal. You know, I know we always want to try to limit narcotic use. In these cases, though, sometimes, especially for a couple of days immediately after the procedure, it's probably warranted. But also, you know, lidoderm, lidocaine patches, topical therapies can be super effective in this patient population as well.
And so to wrap up this last pearl, if we're worried about malignant pleural effusion, we should tap that effusion and the cytology might come back negative the first time, but on a repeated thoracentesis, we can usually increase our cytological yield.
And when treating these recurrent pleural effusions, we do have a couple of options to choose from. These include repeated thoracentesis, indwelling pleural catheters, and pleuridesis with a sclerosing agent.
And of course, each of these procedures is not without side effects. And so really important to kind of sit with that patient and what their goals of care and wishes are and what may be best for them. And with that, that is a wrap for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you got some value from this podcast, our one ask is that you share this podcast with at least one other colleague who might also get something from this episode.
And thanks to our reviewers for this podcast. Thank you, Dr. Stephen Parkin, for the accompanying graphics. And the episode was made as part of the digital education track at BIBMC.
Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thank you.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper. Distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard-of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.